Miranda takes an interest in an anonymous client. Miranda scanned her balance sheet at the end of 1 month and discovered that her leading source of income was no longer Silk Road or Taming of the Shrew. It was that storybook about Princess Nell. In a way, that was surprising, because kid stuff usually didn't pay well. But in another way, it wasn't, because she had been spending an incredible amount of time in that Ractive lately. It had started small. A story, just a few minutes long, involving a dark castle, a wicked stepmother, and a gate with 12 locks. It would have been forgettable, except for two things. It paid much better than most kid work, because they were specifically looking for highly rated actresses. And it was rather dark and weird by the standards of contemporary children's literature. Not many people were into that whole Grimm Brothers scene anymore. She collected a few yukus for her trouble and forgot about it. A, the same contract number came up on her Mediatron again. She accepted the job and found herself reading the same story, except that it was longer and more involved, and it kept backtracking and focusing in on tiny little bits of itself, which then expanded into stories in their own right. Because of the way that the Ractive was hooked up, she didn't get direct feedback from her counterpart on the other end. She assumed it was a little girl, but she couldn't hear the girl's voice. Miranda was presented with screens of text to be read, and she read them. But she could tell that this process of probing and focusing was being directed by the girl. She had seen this during her governess days. She knew that on the other end of this connection was a little girl insatiably asking why. So she put a little gush of enthusiasm into her voice at the beginning of each line, as if she were delighted that the question had been asked. When the session was over, the usual screen came up telling her how much she'd made, the contract number, and so on. Before she signed off on it, she checked the little box labeled, "Mark here if you would like a continuing relationship with this contract." The relationship box, they called it, and it only came up with higher quality Ractives, where continuity was important. The disping process worked so well that any Ractor, male or female, bass or soprano, would sound the same to the end user. The discriminating customers could, of course, tell Ractors apart anyway because of subtle differences in style, and once they had a relationship with one performer, they liked to keep it. Once Miranda checked the box and signed off, she'd get first crack at any more Princess Nell jobs. Within a week, she was teaching this girl how to read. They'd work on letters for a while, and then wander off into more stories about Princess Nell, stop in the middle for a quick practical demonstration of basic math, return to the story, and then get sidetracked with an endless chain of why this and why that. Miranda had spent a lot of time with kiddie Ractives, both as a child and as a governess, and the superiority of this thing was palpable. Like hefting an antique silver fork when you'd been eating with plastic utensils for 20 years, or slithering into a tailor-made evening gown when you were used to jeans. These and other associations came into Miranda's mind on any of the rare moments when she came into contact with something of quality. And if she didn't make a conscious effort to stop the process, she would end up remembering just about everything that had happened to her during the first years of her life. The Mercedes taking her to private school. The crystal chandelier that would ring like fairy bells when she climbed up on the huge mahogany dinner table to tickle it. Her paneled bedroom with a four-poster bed with a silk and goose-down duvet. For reasons still unspecified, Mother had moved them far away from all of that, into what passed for poverty these days. Miranda only remembered that, when she'd been physically close to Father, Mother had watched them with more vigilance than seemed warranted. A month or two into the relationship, Miranda groggily signed off from a long Princess Nell session and was astounded to notice that she'd been going for 8 hours without a break. Her throat was raw, and she hadn't been to the loo in hours. She had made a lot of money. And the time in New York was something like 6 in the morning, which made it seem unlikely that the little girl lived there. She must be in a time zone not many hours different from Miranda's. And she must sit there playing with that Ractive storybook all day long instead of going to school like a little rich girl should. It was slim evidence to go on, but Miranda never needed much evidence to confirm her belief that rich parents were just as capable of fucking with their children's minds as anyone. Further experiences with the Primer. Princess Nell and Harv in the Dark Castle. Harv was a clever boy, who knew about trolls, and so as soon as he knew that they had been locked up inside the dark castle by their wicked stepmother, he told Nell that they must go out and gather all the firewood they could find. Rummaging in the great hall of the castle, he found a suit of armor holding a battle axe. "I will chop down some trees with this," he said, "and you must go out and gather kindling." "What's kindling?" Nell asked. An illustration of the castle appeared. In the center was a tall building with many towers that rose up into the clouds. Around it was an open space where trees and plants grew, and around that was the high wall that held them prisoner. The illustration zoomed in on an open grassy area and became very detailed. Harv and Nell were trying to build a fire. There was a pile of wet logs Harv had chopped up. Harv also had a rock, which he was striking against the butt of a knife. Sparks flew out and were swallowed up by the wet logs. "You start the fire, Nell," Harv said, and left her alone. Then the picture stopped moving, and Nell realized, after a few minutes, that it was fully reactive now. She picked up the rock and the knife and began to whack them together. Actually, she was just moving her empty hands in space, but in the illustration, Princess Nell's hands did the same thing. Sparks flew, but there was no fire. She kept at it for a while, getting more and more frustrated, until tears came to her eyes. But then one of the sparks went awry and landed in some dry grass. A little curl of smoke rose up and died out. She experimented a bit and learned that dry yellow grass worked better than green grass. Still, the fire never lasted for more than a few seconds. A gust of wind came up and blew a few dry leaves in her direction. She learned that the fire could spread from dry grass to leaves. The stem of a leaf was basically a small dry twig, so that gave her the idea to explore a little grove of trees and look for some twigs. The grove was densely overgrown, but she found what she was looking for beneath an old dead bush. "Good," Harv said when he came back and found her approaching with an armload of small dry sticks. "You found some kindling. You're a smart girl and a good worker." Soon they had built up a roaring bonfire. Harv chopped down enough trees to make sure that they could keep it going until sunrise, and then he and Nell fell asleep, knowing that trolls would not dare approach the fire. Still, Nell did not sleep very well, for she could hear the mutterings of the trolls off in the darkness and see the red sparks of their eyes. She thought she heard another sound, too, muffled voices crying for help. When the sun came up, Nell explored the dark castle, looking for the source of the voices, but found nothing. Harv spent the whole day chopping wood. The day before, he had cut down a third of the trees, and this day he cut down another third. That night, Nell again heard the voices, but this time they seemed to be shouting, "Look in the trees! Look in the trees!" The next morning, she went into the remaining grove of trees and explored it, even as Harv was cutting the last of them down. Again, she found nothing. Neither one of them slept well that night, for they knew that they were burning the last of their wood, and that the next night they would have no protection from the trolls. Nell heard the voices again, and this time they seemed to be shouting, "Look under the ground! Look under the ground!" Later, after the sun came up, she went exploring again and found a cave whose entrance had been shut up by trolls. When she opened the cave, she found four dolls: a dinosaur, a duck, a rabbit, and a woman with long purple hair. But she did not see anything living that could have made the voices. Nell and Harv went into the dark castle itself that night and shut themselves up in a room high in one tower and pushed heavy furniture against the door, hoping that it would keep the trolls at bay. The room had one tiny window, and Nell stood next to it, watching the sun go down, wondering if she would see it rise again. Just as the last glimmer of red light disappeared beneath the horizon, she felt a puff of air at her back and turned around to see an astonishing sight. The stuffed animals had turned into real creatures. There was a great, scary dinosaur, a duck, a clever little bunny rabbit, and a woman in a purple gown with purple hair. They explained to Princess Nell that her wicked stepmother was an evil sorceress in the land beyond, and that the four of them had long ago sworn to defeat her evil plans. She had placed an enchantment on them, so that they were dolls in the daytime, but returned to their normal selves at night. Then she had imprisoned them in this castle, where the trolls had shut them up inside a cave. They thanked Nell for releasing them. Then Nell told them her own story. When she mentioned how she and Harve had been plucked from the ocean wrapped in cloth of gold, the woman named Purple said,
"This means that you are a true princess, and so we pledge our undying loyalty to you."
And all four of them bent down on one knee and swore an oath to defend Princess Nell to the death. Dinosaur, who was the fiercest of them all, mounted a campaign to stamp out the trolls, and within a few days they had all been driven away. Thereafter, Nell was no longer troubled in her sleep, for she knew that the scary trolls, who had once given her bad dreams, had been replaced by her four night friends. The Torture Chamber of Judge Fang. A barbarian is interrogated. Dark events in the interior of China. An unignorable summons from Dr. X. Judge Fang didn't torture people frequently. This was for several reasons. Under the new system of Confucian justice, it was no longer necessary for every criminal to sign a confession before a sentence was carried out. All that was needed was for the magistrate to find him guilty on the strength of the evidence. This alone relieved the judge of having to torture many of the people who came before his bench, though he was often tempted to force confessions from insolent Western thieves who refused to take responsibility for their own actions. Furthermore, modern surveillance equipment made it possible to gather information without having to rely on, sometimes reticent, human witnesses as the magistrates of yore had done. But the man with the red dreadlocks was a very reluctant witness indeed, and unfortunately the information locked up in his brain was unique. No airborne Cine aerostat or microscopic surveillance mite had recorded the data Judge Fang sought, and so the magistrate had decided to revert to the time-honored methods of his venerable predecessors. Chang strapped the prisoner, who would only identify himself as Mr. Firefox, to a heavy, X-shaped rack that was normally used for canings. This was purely a humanitarian gesture. It would prevent Firefox from thrashing wildly around the room and injuring himself. Chang also stripped the prisoner from the waist down and situated a bucket under his organs of elimination. In so doing, he happened to expose the only actual injury that the prisoner would suffer during this entire procedure. A tiny, neat scab in the base of the spine, where the court physician had thrust in the spinal tap the previous afternoon and introduced a set of nanocytes, nanotechnological parasites, under the supervision of Miss Pao. In the ensuing 12 hours, the sites had migrated up and down the prisoner's spinal column, drifting lazily through the cerebrospinal fluid, and situated themselves on whatever afferent nerves they happened to bump up against. These nerves, used by the body to transmit information such as, to name only one example, excruciating pain to the brain, had a distinctive texture and appearance that the sites were clever enough to recognize. It is probably superfluous to mention that these sites had one other key feature, namely the ability to transmit bogus information along those nerves. That tiny scab, just above the buttocks, always drew Judge Fang's attention when he presided over one of these affairs, which, fortunately, was not more than a few times a year. Firefox, being a natural redhead, had deathly pale skin. "Cool!" the prisoner suddenly exclaimed, swiveling his head around in a spray of dreadlocks, trying as best he could to look down and back over his freckled shoulder.
"I got this feeling of, like, stroking some, like, really soft fur or something against my left inner thigh. That is so bitching. Do it again, man." "Whoa, wait a minute. Now it's the same feeling, but it's like on the sole of my right foot."
"The attachment of the nanocytes to the nerves is an aleatory process. We never know which nanocyte will end up where. The sensations you are experiencing now are a way for us to take inventory, as it were. Of course, Nothing is actually happening in your thigh or foot. It all takes place within the spinal column, and you would feel it even if your legs had been amputated.
That's really weird,
Firefox exclaimed, his pale green eyes going wide with amazement.
So you could even, like, torture a basket case?
His eye and cheek twitched on one side.
Damn, feels like someone's tickling my face now. Hey, cut it out.
A grin came over his face.
Oh, no, I'll tell you everything. Just don't tickle me, please.
Chang was first stunned and then furious at the prisoner's breach of decorum and made a move toward a rack of canes mounted to the wall. Judge Fang steadied his assistant with a firm hand on the shoulder. Chang swallowed his anger and took a deep breath, then bowed apologetically.
You know, Firefox, Judge Fang said, I really appreciate the moments of levity and even childlike wonder that you are injecting into this process. So often when we strap people to the torture rack, they are unpleasantly tense and hardly any fun at all to be around.
Hey, man, I'm into new experiences. I get lots of experience points for this, huh?
Experience points?
It's a joke. From swords and sorcery reactives. See, the more experience points your character earns, the more power he gets.
Judge Fang straightened one hand and snapped it backward past his head, making a whooshing sound like a low-flying fighter plane. The reference escaped me, he explained for the benefit of Chang and Miss Pao, who did not recognize the gesture.
Feels like there's something tickling my right eardrum now,
the prisoner said, snapping his head back and forth.
Good. That means a nanocyte happened to attach itself to the nerve running from your eardrum into your brain. We always consider it an omen of good fortune when this happens, Judge Fang said, as pain impulses delivered into this nerve make a particularly deep impression on the subject. Now, I will ask Miss Pao to suspend this process for a few minutes so that I can have your full attention. Cool,
said the prisoner. Let's review what we have so far. You are 37 years old. Almost 20 years ago, you co-founded a CryptNet node in Oakland, California. It was a very early node, number 178. Now, of course, there are tens of thousands of nodes. A hint of a smile from the prisoner.
You almost got me there, he said. No way am I going to tell you how many nodes there are. Of course, no one really knows anyway.
Very well, Judge Fang said. He nodded to Chang, who made a mark on a sheet of paper. We will save that inquiry for the latter phase of the investigation, which will commence in a few minutes. Like all other CryptNet members, Judge Fang continued, you started out at the first level and made your way up from there as the years went by to your current level of... what? Firefox smirked and shook his head knowingly.
I'm sorry, Judge Fang, but we've been through this. I can't deny I started out at level one. I mean, that's, like, obvious. But anything beyond that point is speculation.
It's only speculation if you don't tell us, Judge Fang said, controlling a momentary spark of annoyance. I suspect you of being at least a 25th level member. Firefox got a serious look on his face and shook his head, jangling the shiny, colorful fragments of glass and metal worked into his dreadlocks.
That is so bogus. You should know that the highest level is 10. Anything beyond that is like a myth. Only conspiracy theorists believe in levels beyond 10. CryptNet is just a simple, innocuous, tuple processing collective, man.
That is, of course, the party line, which is only believed by complete idiots, Judge Fang said. In any case, returning to your previous statement, we have established that over the next 8 years, Node 178 did a prosperous business, as you said, processing tuples. During this time, you worked your way up the hierarchy to the 10th level. Then you claimed to have severed your connection with CryptNet and gone into business for yourself, as a media grapher. Since then, you've specialized in war zones. Your photo, cine, and sound collages from the battlegrounds of China have won prizes and been accessed by hundreds of thousands of media consumers, though your work is so graphic and disturbing that mainstream acceptance has eluded you.
That's your opinion, man.
Chang stepped forward, visibly clenching the many stout muscles that enwreathed his big, bony, close-cropped head.
You will address the magistrate as your honor,
he hissed.
"Chill out, man," Firefox said. "Geez, who's torturing whom here?"
Judge Fang exchanged a look with Chang. Chang, out of sight of the prisoner, licked one index finger and made an imaginary mark in the air. Score one for Firefox.
Many of us who are not part of Cryptnet find it hard to understand how that organization can survive its extremely high attrition rate. Over and over again, first-level Cryptnet novices work their way up the hierarchy to the 10th and supposedly highest level, then drop out and seek other work or simply fade back into the files from which they originated. Firefox tried to shrug insouciantly, but was too effectively restrained to complete the maneuver. Judge Fang continued, "This pattern has been widely noted and has led to speculation that Cryptnet contains many levels beyond the 10th, and that all of the people pretending to be ex-Cryptnet members are, in fact, secretly connected to the old network, secretly in communication with all of the other nodes, secretly working their way up to higher and higher levels within Cryptnet, even while infiltrating the power structures of other files and organizations. That Cryptnet is a powerful secret society that has spread its tendrils high into every file and corporation in the world." That is so paranoid.
Normally, we do not concern ourselves with these matters, which may be mere paranoid ravings, as you aver. There are those who would claim that the Chinese Coastal Republic, of which I am a servant, is riddled with secret Cryptnet members. I myself am skeptical of this. Even if it were true, it would only matter to me if they committed crimes within my jurisdiction. And it could scarcely make any difference anyway, Judge Fang added to himself, given that the Coastal Republic is completely riddled with corruption and intrigue under the best of circumstances. The darkest and most powerful conspiracy in the world would be chewed up and spat out by the scheming corporate warlords of the Coastal Republic. Judge Fang realized that everyone was looking at him, waiting for him to continue.
"You were spacing out, Your Honor," Firefox said.
Judge Fang had been spacing out quite a bit lately, usually while pondering this very subject. Corrupt and incompetent government was hardly a new development in China, and the master himself had devoted many parts of the Analects to advising his followers in how they should comport themselves while working in the service of corrupt lords. "A superior man indeed is Chu Po Yu. When good government prevails in his state, he is to be found in office. When bad government prevails, he can roll his principles up and keep them in his breast." One of the great virtues of Confucianism was its suppleness. Western political thought tended to be rather brittle. As soon as the state became corrupt, everything ceased to make sense. Confucianism always retained its equilibrium, like a cork that could float as well in spring water or raw sewage. Nevertheless, Judge Fang had recently been plagued with doubts as to whether his life made any sense at all in the context of the Coastal Republic, a nation almost completely devoid of virtue. If the Coastal Republic had believed in the existence of virtue, it could at least have aspired to hypocrisy. He was getting off the track here. The issue was not whether the Coastal Republic was well-governed. The issue was trafficking in babies. 3 months ago, Judge Fang said, you arrived in Shanghai via airship, and, after a short stay, proceeded into the interior via a hovercraft on the Yangtze. Your stated mission was to gather material for a mediographic documentary concerning a new criminal gang. Here Judge Fang referred to his notes. Called the Fists of Righteous Harmony.
It ain't no small-time triad, Firefox said, smiling exultantly. It's the seeds of a dynastic rebellion, man.
I've reviewed the media you transmitted back to the outside world on this subject, Judge Fang said, and will make my own judgment. The prospects of the Fists are not at issue here. Firefox was not at all convinced. He raised his head and opened his mouth to explain to Judge Fang how wrong he was, then thought better of it, shook his head regretfully, and acquiesced.
2 days ago, Judge Fang continued, you returned to Shanghai in a riverboat badly overloaded with several dozen passengers, most of them peasants fleeing from famine and strife in the interior.
He was now reading from a Shanghai harbormaster document detailing the inspection of the boat in question.
I note that several of the passengers were women carrying female infants under 3 months of age.
the vessel was searched for contraband and admitted into the harbor. Judge Fang did not need to point out that this meant practically nothing. Such inspectors were notoriously unobservant, especially when in the presence of distractions such as envelopes full of money, fresh cartons of cigarettes, or conspicuously amorous young passengers. But the more corrupt a society was, the more apt its officials were to brandish pathetic internal documents such as this one, as if they were holy writ, and Judge Fang was no exception to this rule when it served a higher purpose. All of the passengers, including the infants, were processed in the usual way, records taken of retinal patterns, fingerprints, etc. I regret to say that my esteemed colleagues in the harbor master's office did not examine these records with their wonted diligence, for if they had, they might have noticed large discrepancies between the biological characteristics of the young women and their alleged daughters, suggesting that none of them were actually related to each other. But perhaps more pressing matters prevented them from noticing this. Judge Fang let the unspoken accusation hang in the air, that the Shanghai authorities were themselves not out of reach of Cryptnet influence. Firefox visibly tried to look ingenuous. A day later, during a routine investigation of organized crime activity in the leased territories, we placed a surveillance device in an allegedly vacant apartment thought to be used for illegal activities, and were startled to hear the sound of many small infants. Constables raided the place immediately and found 24 female infants belonging to the Han racial group being cared for by 8 young peasant women recently arrived from the countryside. Upon interrogation, these women said that they had been recruited for this work by a Han gentleman whose identity has not been established and who has not been found. The infants were examined. 5 of them were on your boat, Mr. Firefox. The biological records match perfectly. If there was a baby smuggling operation associated with that boat, Firefox said, I had nothing to do with it. We've interrogated the boat's owner and captain, Judge Fang said, and he asserts that this voyage was planned and paid for by you, from beginning to end. I had to get back to Shanghai somehow, so I hired the boat. These women wanted to go to Shanghai, so I was cool about letting them come along. Mr. Firefox, before we start torturing you, let me explain to you my state of mind, Judge Fang said, coming close to the prisoner so that they could look each other in the eye. We have examined these babies closely. It appears that they were well cared for, no malnourishment or signs of abuse. Why, then, should I take such an interest in this case? The answer has nothing to do, really, with my duties as a district magistrate. It doesn't even relate to Confucian philosophy per se. It is a racial thing, Mr. Firefox, that a European man is smuggling Han babies to the leased territories and thence, I would assume, out to the world beyond, triggers profound, I might even say, primal emotions within me and many other Chinese persons. During the Boxer Rebellion, the rumor was spread that the orphanages run by European missionaries were in fact abattoirs where white doctors scooped the eyes out of the heads of Han babies to make medicine for European consumption. That many Han believe these rumors accounts for the extreme violence to which the Europeans were subjected during that rebellion. But it also reflects a regrettable predisposition to racial fear and hatred that is latent within the breasts of all human beings of all tribes. With your baby smuggling operation, you have stumbled into the same extremely dangerous territory. Perhaps these little girls are destined for comfortable and loving homes in non-hand files. That is the best possible outcome for you. You will be punished, but you will live. But for all I know, they are being used for organ transplants. In other words, the baseless rumors that incited peasants to storm the orphanages during the Boxer Rebellion may in fact be literally true in your case. Does this help to clarify the purpose of this evening's little get-together? At the beginning of this oration, Firefox had been wearing his baseline facial expression, an infuriatingly vacant half-grin, which Judge Fang had decided was not really a smirk, more a posture of detached bemusement. As soon as Judge Fang had mentioned the eyeballs, the prisoner had broken eye contact,
lost the smile, and become more and more pensive until, by the end, he was actually nodding in agreement. He kept on nodding for a minute longer, staring fixedly at the floor. Then he brightened and looked up at the judge.
"Before I give you my answer," he said, "torture me."
Judge Fang, by a conscious effort, remained poker-faced. So Firefox twisted his head around until Miss Powell was within his peripheral vision.
"Go ahead," the prisoner said encouragingly. "Give me a jolt."
Judge Fang shrugged and nodded to Miss Powell, who picked up her brush and swept a few quick characters across the mediatronic paper spread out on the writing table before her. As she neared the end of this inscription, she slowed and finally looked up at the judge, then at Firefox, as she drew out the final stroke. At this point, Firefox should have erupted with a scream from deep down in his viscera, convulsed against the restraints, voided himself at both ends, then gone into shock, if he had a weak constitution, or begged for mercy, if strong. Instead, he closed his eyes, as if thinking hard about something, tensed every muscle in his body for a few moments, then gradually relaxed, breathing deeply and deliberately. He opened his eyes and looked at Judge Fang.
"How's that?" the prisoner said. "Would you like another demonstration?"
"I think I have the general idea," Judge Fang said. "One of your high-level cryptnet tricks, I suppose. Nanocytes embedded in your brain, mediating its interchanges with the peripheral nervous system. It would make sense for you to have advanced telesthetic systems permanently installed. And a system that could trick your nerves into thinking that they were somewhere else could also trick them into thinking that they were not experiencing pain."
"What can be installed can be removed," Miss Powell observed.
"That won't be necessary," Judge Fang said, and nodded to Chang. Chang stepped toward the prisoner, drawing a short sword. "We'll start with fingers and proceed from there."
"You're forgetting something," the prisoner said. "I have already agreed to give you my answer."
"I'm standing here," the judge said. "I'm not hearing an answer. Is there a reason for this delay?"
"The babies aren't being smuggled anywhere," Firefox said. "They stay right here. The purpose of the operation is to save their lives."
"What is it precisely that endangers their lives?"
"Their own parents," Firefox said. "Things are bad in the interior, Your Honor. The water table is gone. The practice of infanticide is at an all-time high."
"Your next goal in life," Judge Fang said, "will be to prove all of this to my satisfaction." The door opened. One of Judge Fang's constables entered the room and bowed deeply to apologize for the interruption, then stepped forward and handed the magistrate a scroll. The judge examined the seal. It bore the chop of Dr. X. He carried it into his office and unrolled it on his desk. It was the real thing, written on rice paper in real ink, not the mediatronic stuff. It occurred to the judge, before he even read this document, that he could take it to an art dealer on Nanjing Road and sell it for a year's wages. Dr. X, assuming it was really he who had brushed these characters, was the most impressive living calligrapher whose work Judge Fang had ever seen. His hand betrayed a rigorous Confucian grounding, many decades more study than Judge Fang could ever aspire to. But upon this foundation, the doctor had developed a distinctive style, highly expressive without being sloppy. It was the hand of an elder who understood the importance of gravity above all else and who, having first established his dignity, conveyed most of his message through nuances. Beyond that, the structure of the inscription was exactly right, a perfect balance of large characters and small, hung on the page just so as if inviting analysis by legions of future graduate students. Judge Fang knew that Dr. X controlled legions of criminals ranging from spankable delinquents up to international crime lords, that half of the Coastal Republic officials in Shanghai were in his pocket, that within the limited boundaries of the Celestial Kingdom, he was a figure of considerable importance, probably a blue-button mandarin of the third or fourth rank, that his business connections ran to most of the continents and files of the wide world, and that he had accumulated tremendous wealth. All of these things paled in comparison with the demonstration of power represented by this scroll.
I can pick up a brush at any time, Dr. X was saying, and toss off a work of art that can hang on the wall beside the finest calligraphy of the Ming Dynasty. By sending the judge this scroll, Dr. X was laying claim to all of the heritage that Judge Fang most revered. It was like getting a letter from the master himself. The doctor was, in effect, pulling rank. And even though Dr. X nominally belonged to a different file, the Celestial Kingdom, and here in the Coastal Republic was nothing more than a criminal, Judge Fang could not disregard this message from him, written in this way, without abjuring everything he most respected. Those principles on which he had rebuilt his own life after his career as a hoodlum in Lower Manhattan had brought him to a dead end. It was like a summons sent down through the ages from his own ancestors. He spent a few minutes further admiring the calligraphy. Then he rolled the scroll up with great care, locked it in a drawer, and returned to the interrogation room. "I have received an invitation to dine on Dr. X's boat," he said. "Take the prisoner back to the holding cell. We are finished for today." A domestic scene. Nell's visit to the playroom. Misbehavior of the other children. The primer displays new capabilities. Dinosaur tells a story. In the morning, Mom would put on her maid uniform and go to work, and Tad would wake up some time later and colonize the sofa in front of the big living room mediatron. Harv would creep around the edges of the apartment, foraging for breakfast, some of which he'd bring back to Nell. Then Harv would usually leave the apartment and not come back until after Tad had departed, typically in late afternoon, to chill with his homeboys. Mom would come home with a little plastic bag of salad that she'd taken from work and a tiny injector. After picking at the salad, she'd put the injector against her arm for a moment and then spend the rest of the evening watching old passives on the Mediatron. Harv would drift in and out with some of his friends. Usually he wasn't there when Nell decided to go to sleep, but he was there when she woke up. Tad might come home at any time of the night, and he'd be angry if Mom wasn't awake. One Saturday, Mom and Tad were both home at the same time, and they were on the couch together with their arms around each other, and Tad was playing a silly game with Mom that made Mom squeal and wiggle. Nell kept asking Mom to read her a story from her magic book, and Tad kept shoving her away and threatening to give her a whipping. And finally Mom said, "Get out of my fucking hair, Nell," and shoved Nell out the door, telling her to go to the playroom for a couple of hours. Nell got lost in the hallways and started crying, but her book told her a story about Princess Nell getting lost in the endless corridors of the Dark Castle and how she found her way out by using her wits, and this made Nell feel safe, as though she could never be really lost when she had her book with her. Eventually, Nell found the playroom. It was on the first floor of the building. As usual, there were lots of kids there and no parents. There was a special space off to the side of the playroom where babies could sit in strollers and crawl around on the floor. Some mommies were in there, but they told her she was too big to play in that room. Nell went back to the big playroom, which was full of kids who were much bigger than Nell. She knew these kids. They knew how to push and hit and scratch. She went to one corner of the room and sat with her magic book on her lap, waiting for one kid to get off the swing. When he did, she put her book in the corner and climbed onto the swing and started trying to pump her legs like the big kids did, but she couldn't get the swing to go. Then a big kid came and told her that she was not allowed to use the swing because she was too little. When Nell didn't get off right away, the kid shoved her off. Nell tumbled into the sand, scratching her hands and knees, and ran back toward the corner crying. But a couple of other kids had found her magic book and started kicking it around, making it slide back and forth across the floor like a hockey puck. Nell ran up and tried to pick the book off the floor, but it slid too fast for her to catch it. The two kids began kicking it back and forth between them and finally tossing it through the air. Nell ran back and forth trying to keep up with the book. Soon there were four kids playing keep away and six others standing around watching and laughing at Nell. Nell couldn't see things, though, because her eyes were full of tears, snot was running out of her nose, and her ribcage only quivered when she tried to breathe. Then one of the kids screamed and dropped the book. Quickly another darted in to grab it, and he screamed too. Then a third. Suddenly all the kids were silent and afraid. Nell rubbed the tears out of her eyes and ran over toward the book again, and this time the kids didn't throw it away from her. She picked it up and cradled it against her chest. The kids who'd been playing keep away were all in the same pose, arms crossed over chests, hands wedged into armpits, jumping up and down like pogo sticks and screaming for their mothers. Nell sat in the corner, opened the book, and started to read. She did not know all of the words, but she knew a lot of them, and when she got tired, the book would help her sound out the words, or even read the whole story to her, or tell it to her with moving pictures just like a cine. After the trolls had all been driven away, the castle yard was not a pretty sight to see. It had been unkempt and overgrown to begin with. Harv had had no choice except to chop down all the trees, and during Dinosaur's great battle against the trolls, many of the remaining plants had been torn up. Dinosaur stood and surveyed it in the moonlight. "This place reminds me of the extinction, when we had to wander for days just to find something to eat," he said. Dinosaur's Tale. There were four of us traveling through a landscape much like this one, except that instead of stumps, all the trees were burned. The particular part of the world had become dark and cold for a while after the comet struck, so that many of the plants and trees died. And after they died, they dried out, and then it was just a matter of time before lightning caused a great forest fire. The four of us were traveling across this great burnt-out country looking for food, and you can guess we were very hungry. Never mind why we were doing it. Back then, if things got bad where you were, you just got up and went until things got better. Besides me, there was Utahraptor, who was smaller than me but very quick, with great curving claws on his feet. With one kick, he could cut another dinosaur open like ripe fruit. Then there was Ankylosaurus, who was a slow plant-eater but dangerous. He was protected all around by a bony shell like a turtle's, and on the end of his tail was a big lump of bone that could dash out the brains of any meat-eating dinosaur that came too close. Finally, there was Pteranodon, who could fly. All of us traveled together in a little pack. To be perfectly honest, our band had formerly consisted of a couple of hundred dinosaurs, most of them duck-billed plant-eaters. But Utahraptor and I had been forced to eat most of these, just a few a day, of course, so they didn't notice at first, as they were not very intelligent. Finally, their number had dwindled to one, a gaunt and gamey fellow named Everett, whom we tried to stretch out for as long as we could. During those last few days, Everett was constantly looking around for his companions. Like all plant-eaters, he had eyes in the side of his head and could see in almost all directions. Everett seemed to think that if he could just swivel his head around in the right direction, a big, healthy pack of duckbills would suddenly rotate into view. At the very end, I think that Everett may have put two and two together. I saw him blink in surprise once, as if the light had finally gone on in his head, and the rest of that day he was very quiet, as if all of his half-dozen or so neurons were busy working out the implications. After that, as we continued across this burned country where Everett had nothing to eat, he became more and more listless and whiny until finally Utahraptor lost his temper, lashed out with one leg, and there was Everett's viscera, sitting there on the ground like a sack of groceries. Then there was simply nothing to do except eat him. I got most of him as usual, though Utahraptor kept darting in around the ankles and snatching up choice bits, and from time to time Pteranodon would swoop in and grab a whorl of intestine. Ankylosaurus stood off to the side and watched. For a long time we'd taken him for an idiot, because he would always just squat there watching us divide up those duckbills, munching stupidly on the erratic horsetail, never saying much. In retrospect, maybe he was just a taciturn sort. He must have worked out that we would very much like to eat him if only we could locate some chink in his armor. If only we had. For many days after Everett had become just another scat on our tracks, Utahraptor and Pteranodon and I trudged across that dead landscape, eyeing Ankylosaurus, drooling down our chins as we imagined the unspeakably tender morsels that must lie nestled inside that armored shell. He must have been hungry too, and no doubt his morsels were getting less fat and tender by the day. From time to time, we would encounter some sheltered hollow where unfamiliar green plants were poking their shoots through the black and grey debris, and we would encourage Ankylosaurus to stop, take his time, and eat all he wanted.
"No, really!"
Really, we don't mind waiting for you.
He would always fix his tiny, little side-mounted eyes on us and look at us balefully as he grazed.
How was your dinner, Anki?
We'd say, and he'd grumble something like, "Tastes like iridium as usual." And then we'd go another couple of days without exchanging a word. One day, we reached the edge of the sea. The salt water lapped up onto a lifeless beach strewn with the bones of extinct sea creatures, from tiny trilobites all the way up to plesiosaurs. Behind us was the desert we'd just crossed. To the south was a range of mountains that would have been impassable even if half of them hadn't been erupting volcanoes. And north of us we could see snow dusting the tops of the hills, and we all knew what that meant. If we went in that direction, we'd soon freeze to death. So we were stuck there, the four of us, and though we didn't have mediatrons and cine aerostats in those days, we all pretty much knew what was up. We were the last four dinosaurs on Earth. Pretty soon, we would be three, and then two, and then one, and then none at all. And the only question left to settle was, in what order we'd go. You might think this would be awful and depressing, but it wasn't really that bad. Being dinosaurs, we didn't spend a lot of time pondering the imponderables, if you know what I mean. And in a way, it was kind of fun waiting to see how it would all work out. There was a general assumption on all hands, I think, that Ankylosaurus would be the first to go, but Utah and I would have killed each other in an instant. So we all kind of faced off on the beach there, Utahraptor and Ankylosaurus and I in a neat triangle with Pteranodon hovering overhead. After we'd been facing off there for some hours, I noticed out of the corner of my eye that the banks to the north and south seemed to be moving, as if they were alive. Suddenly, there was a thundering and rushing sound in the air all around us, and I couldn't help looking up, though I kept one sharp eye on Utahraptor. The world had been such a quiet and dead place for so long that we were startled by any noise or movement, and now it seemed that the air and ground had come alive once more, just as in the old days before the comet. The noise in the air was caused by a great flock of teensy-tiny pteranodons, though instead of smooth reptilian skin, their wings were covered with oversized scales, and they had toothless, bony beaks instead of proper mouths. These miserable things, these airborne crumbs, were swarming all around Pteranodon, getting in his eyes, pecking at his wings, and it was all he could do to keep airborne. As I mentioned, I was keeping one eye on Utahraptor, as always, and to my surprise, he suddenly turned away and ran up onto the north slope with an eagerness that could be explained only by the availability of food. I followed him, naturally, but pulled up short. Something was wrong. The ground on the north slope was covered with a moving carpet that swarmed around Utahraptor's feet. Focusing my eyes, which frankly were not very good, I saw that this carpet actually consisted of thousands of tiny dinosaurs whose scales had grown very long and slender and numerous. In short, they were furry. I had been seeing these quadrupedal hors d'oeuvres dodging around under logs and rocks for the last few million years, and always taken them for an especially ill-conceived mutation. But suddenly, there were thousands of them, and this at a time when there were only four dinosaurs left in the whole world, and they seemed to be working together. They were so tiny that Utahraptor had no way to get them into his mouth, and whenever he stopped moving for an instant, they swarmed onto his legs and tail and nipped at his flesh. A plague of shrews. I was so confounded that I stopped in my tracks. That was a mistake, for soon I felt a sensation in me legs and tail like millions of pinpricks. Turning around, I saw that the south slope was covered with ants. Millions of them, and they had apparently decided to eat me. Meanwhile, Ankylosaurus was bellowing and swinging his bony ball around without effect, for the ants were swarming on his body as well.